that a few of the men might be put to the question. He refused. I gave Edmure my word that if he yielded, the garrison could leave unharmed. "And that was chivalrous of you," his aunt said. "But it's strength that's needed here, not chivalry."
"Huh. Ask Edmure how chivalrous I am," thought Jamie. "Ask him about the trebuchet."
Somehow he did not think the maesters were like to confuse him with Prince Aemon the Dragonite when they wrote their histories. Still, he felt curiously content. The war was all but won. Dragonstone had fallen, and Storm's End would soon enough. He could not doubt, and Stannis was welcome to the wall. The Northmen would love him no more than the Stormlords had. If Roose Bolton did not destroy him, Winter would. And he had done his own part here at Riverrun, without actually ever taking up arms against the Starks or Tullys. Once he found the Blackfish, he would be free to return to King's Landing, where he belonged.
"My place is with my king, with my son."
Would Tommen want to know that? The truth could cost the boy his throne.
"Would you sooner have a father or a chair, lad?"
Jamie wished he knew the answer.
"Well, he does like stamping papers with his seal."
The boy might not even believe him, to be sure. Cersei would say it was a lie.
"My sweet sister, the deceiver." He would need to find some way to winkle Tommen from her clutches before the boy became another Joffrey. And whilst at that, he should find the lad a new small council, too. If Cersei can be put aside, Sir Kevin may agree to serve as Tommen's hand. And if not, well, the Seven Kingdoms did not lack for able men. Fawley Prester would make a good choice. Or Roland Craighall.
If someone other than a Westerman was needed to appease the Tyrells, there was always Mathis Rowan, or even Peter Baelish. Littlefinger was as amiable as he was clever, but too low-born to threaten any of the great lords, with no swords of his own. The perfect hand. The Tully garrison departed the next morning, stripped of all their arms and armour. Each man was allowed 3 days' food and the clothing on his back, after he swore a solemn oath never to take up arms against Lord Emmon or House Lannister. "If you're fortunate, 1 man in 10 may keep that vow," Lady Jenna said.
"Good. I'd sooner face 9 men than 10. The 10th might have been the one who would have killed me."
"The other 9 will kill you just as quickly."
"Better than to die in bed, or on the privy."
2 men did not choose to depart with the others. Sir Desmond Grell, Lord Huster's old master-at-arms, prepared to take the black. So did Sir Robin Rieger, Riverrun's captain of guards.
"This castle has been my home for 40 years, said Grell. "You say I'm free to go, but where? I'm too old and too stout to make a hedge knight. But men are always welcome at the wall."
"As you wish," said Jamie, though it was a bloody nuisance. He allowed them to keep their arms and armour, and assigned 12 of Gregor Clegane's men to escort the 2 of them to Maidenpool. The command he gave to Raffet, the one they called the Sweetling. "See to it that the prisoners reach Maidenpool unspoiled," he told the man. "Or what Sir Gregor did to the goat will seem a jolly lark compared to what I'll do to you." More days passed. Lord Emmon assembled all of Riverrun in the yard, Lord Edmure's people and his own, and spoke to them for close on 3 hours about what would be expected of them now that he was their lord and master. From time to time he waved his parchment, as stable boys and serving girls and smiths listened in sullen silence, and a light rain fell down upon them all. The singer was listening too, the one that Jamie had taken from Sir Ryman Frey. Jamie came upon him standing inside an open door where it was dry.
"His lordship should have been a singer," the man said.
This speech is longer than a marcher's ballad, and I don't think he stopped for breath.
Jamie had to laugh. Lord Emmon does not need to breathe, so long as he can chew. Are you going to make a song of it?
Ah, a funny one. I'll call it Talking to the Fish.
Just don't play it when my aunt can hear. Jamie had never paid the man much mind before. He was a small fellow, garbed in ragged green breeches and a frayed tunic of a lighter shade of green, with brown leather patches covering the holes. His nose was long and sharp, his smile big and loose. Thin brown hair fell to his collar, snaggled and unwashed. 50, if he's a day, thought Jamie. A hedge harp, and hard used by life. "Weren't you Sir Ryman's man when I found you?" he asked.
"Only for a fortnight."
"I would have expected you to depart with the frays."
"That one up there's a fray,"
the singer said, nodding at Lord Emmon.
"And this castle seems a nice snug place to pass a winter. White Smile Wat went home with Sir Forley, so I thought I'd see if I could win his place. Wat's got that high, sweet voice that the likes of me can't hope to match, but I know twice as many bawdy songs as he does. Begging my lord's pardon."
"You should get on famously with my aunt," said Jamie. "If you hope to winter here, see that your playing pleases Lady Jenner. She's the one that matters."
"Not you?"
"My place is with the king. I shall not stay here long."
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, my lord. I know better songs than the Rains of Castamere. I could have played you, all sorts of things."
"Some other time," said Jamie. "Do you have a name?"
"Tom of Seven Streams, if it please my lord."
The singer doffed his hat.
"Most call me Thomas Sevens, though."
"Sing sweetly, Thomas Sevens." That night he dreamt that he was back in the great sept of Baelor, still standing vigil over his father's corpse. The sept was still and dark, until a woman emerged from the shadows and walked slowly to the bier. "Sister?" he said. But it was not Cersei. She was all in grey, a silent sister. A hood and veil concealed her features, but he could see the candles burning in the green pools of her eyes. "Sister?" he said. "What would you have of me?" His last word echoed up and down the sept. "Me, me, 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 me." "I am not your sister, Jamie." She raised a pale, soft hand and pushed her hood back. "Have you forgotten me? Can I forget someone I never knew?" The words caught in his throat. He did know her, but it had been so long. "Will you forget your own lord father, too? I wonder if you ever knew him, truly." Her eyes were green, her hair spun gold. He could not tell how old she was. 15, he thought, or 50. She climbed the steps to stand above the bier. He could never abide being laughed at. That was the thing he hated most. "Who are you?" He had to hear her say it. "Question is, who are you?" "This is a dream."
"Is it?"
She smiled sadly. "Count your hands, child." "One." One hand clasped tight around the sword hilt. "Only one. In my dreams, I always have two hands." He raised his right arm and stared uncomprehending at the ugliness of his stump. "We all dream of things we cannot have. Tywin dreamed that his son would be a great knight, that his daughter would be a queen. He dreamed they would be so strong and brave and beautiful that no one would ever laugh at them." "I am a knight," he told her, "and Cersei is a queen." A tear rolled down her cheek. The woman raised her hood again and turned her back on him. Jamie called after her, but already she was moving away, her skirt whispering lullabies as it brushed across the floor. "Don't leave me," he wanted to call, but of course she'd left them long ago. He woke in darkness,
shivering. The room had grown cold as ice. Jamie flung aside the covers with the stump of his sword hand. The fire in the hearth had died, he saw, and the windows had blown open. He crossed the pitch-dark chamber to fumble with the shutters, but when he reached the window, his bare foot came down in something wet. Jamie recoiled, startled for a moment. His first thought was of blood, but blood would not have been so cold. It was snow, drifting through the window. Instead of closing the shutters, he threw them wide. The yard below was covered by a thin white blanket, growing thicker even as he watched. The merlons on the battlements wore white cowls. The flakes fell silently, a few drifting in the window to melt upon his face. Jamie could see his own breath. Snow in the Riverlands? If it was snowing here, it could well be snowing on Lennisport as well, and on King's Landing. Winter is marching south, and half our granaries are empty. Any crops still in the field were doomed. There would be no more plantings, no more hopes of one last harvest. He found himself wondering what his father would do to feed the realm, before he remembered that Tywin Lannister was dead. When morning broke, the snow was ankle-deep, and deeper in the Godswood, where drifts had piled up under the trees. Squires, stable-boys, and high-born pages turned to children again under its cold white spell, and fought a snowball war up and down the wards and all along the battlements. Jamie heard them laughing. There was a time, not long ago, when he might have been out making snowballs with the best of them, to fling at Tyrion when he waddled by or slipped down the back of Cersei's gown. You need two hands to make a decent snowball, though. There was a rap upon his door. See who that is, Peck. It was Riverrun's old maester, with a message clutched in his lined and wrinkled hand. Wyman's face was as pale as the new-fallen snow. "I know," Jamie said, "there has been a white raven from the citadel. Winter has come."
"No, my lord, the bird was from King's Landing. I took the liberty. I did not know."
He held the letter out. Jamie read it in the window-seat, bathed in the light of that cold white morning. Kyburn's words were terse and to the point. Cersei's fevered and fervent.
"Come at once," she said. "Help me. Save me. I need you now, as I have never needed you before. I love you. I love you. I love you. Come at once."
Wyman was hovering by the door, waiting, and Jamie sensed that Peck was watching too.
"Does my lord wish to answer?"
the maester asked, after a long silence. A snowflake landed on the letter. As it melted, the ink began to blur. Jamie rolled the parchment up again, as tight as one hand would allow, and handed it to Peck. "No," he said. "Put this in the fire." Samwell. The most perilous part of the journey was the last. The Red Wind Straits were swarming with longships, as they had been warned in Tyrosh. With the main strength of the Arbor's fleet on the far side of Westeros, the Iron Men had sacked Riamsport and taken Vinetown and Starfish Harbor for their own, using them as bases to prey on shipping bound for Oldtown. Thrice longships were sighted by the Crow's Nest. Two were well astern, however, and the Cinnamon Wind soon outdistanced them. The third appeared near sunset, to cut them off from Whispering Sound. When they saw her oars rising and falling, lashing the copper waters white, Kojo Mo sent her archers to the castles with their great bows of golden heart that could send a shaft farther and truer than even Dornish yew. She waited till the longship came within 200 yards before she gave the command to loose. Sam loosed with them, and this time he thought his arrow reached the ship. One volley was all it took. The longship veered south in search of tamer prey. A deep blue dusk was falling as they entered Whispering Sound. Gillier stood beside the prow with the babe, gazing up at a castle on the cliffs. "Three towers," Sam told her, "the seat of House Costain." Etched against the evening stars with torchlight flickering from its windows, the castle made a splendid sight. But he was sad to see it. Their voyage was almost at its end.
"It's very tall," said Gilly.
"Wait till you see the high tower."
Della's babe began to cry. Gilly pulled open her tunic and gave the boy her breast. She smiled as he nursed and stroked his soft brown hair.
"She has come to love this one as much as the one she left behind," Sam realized. He hoped that the gods would be kind to both of the children.
The Iron Men had penetrated even to the sheltered waters of Whispering Sound. Come morning, as the cinnamon wind continued on toward Old Town, she began to bump up against corpses, drifting down to the sea. Some of the bodies carried complements of crows, who rose into the air complaining noisily when the swan ship disturbed their grotesquely swollen rafts. Scorched fields and burned villages appeared on the banks, and the shallows and sandbars were strewn with shattered ships. Merchanters and fishing boats were the most common, but they saw abandoned longships too, and the wreckage of two big drummonds. One had been burned down to the waterline, whilst the other had a gaping, splintered hole in her side where her hull had been rammed.
"Battle here," said Zondo. "Not so long."
"Who would be so mad as to raid this close to Old Town?"
Zondo pointed to a half-sunken longship in the shallows. The remnants of a banner drooped from her stern, smoke-stained and ragged. The charge was one Sam had never seen before. A red eye with a black pupil beneath a black iron crown supported by two crows.
"Whose banner is that?" Sam asked.
Zondo only shrugged. The next day was cold and misty. As the cinnamon wind was creeping past another plundered fishing village, a war galley came sliding from the fog, stroking slowly toward them. Huntress was the name she bore, behind a figurehead of a slender maiden clad in leaves and brandishing a spear. A heartbeat later, two smaller galleys appeared on either side of her, like a pair of matched greyhounds stalking at their master's heels. To Sam's relief, they flew King Tommen's stag and lion banner above the stepped white tower of Old Town with its crown of flame. The captain of the Huntress was a tall man in a smoke-grey cloak with a border of red satin flames. He brought his galley in alongside the cinnamon wind, raised his oars, and shouted that he was coming aboard. As his crossbowmen and Kojomo's archers eyed each other across the narrow span of water, he crossed over with half a dozen knights, gave Kahuromo a nod, and asked to see his holds. Father and daughter conferred briefly, then agreed.
My apologies," the captain said, when his inspection was complete. "It grieves me that honest men must suffer such discourtesy, but sooner that than iron men in Old Town. Only a fortnight ago, some of those bloody bastards captured a Tairoshi merchantman in the Straits. They killed her crew, donned their clothes, and used the dyes they found to colour their whiskers 100 colours. Once inside the walls, they meant to set the port ablaze and open a gate from within, whilst we fought the fire. It might have worked, but they ran afoul of the Lady of the Tower, and her oarsmaster has a Tairoshi wife. When he saw all the green and purple beards,
he hailed them in the tongue of Tyrosh, and not one of them had the words to hail him back.
Sam was aghast. They cannot mean to raid Old Town. The captain of the Huntress gave him a curious look.
These are no mere reavers. The Iron Men have always raided where they could. They would strike sudden from the sea, carry off some gold and girls, and sail away. But there were seldom more than one or two longships, and never more than half a dozen. Hundreds of their ships afflict us now, sailing out of the Shield Islands and some of the rocks around the harbour. They have taken Stone Crab Key, the Isle of Pigs, and the Mermaid's Palace, and there are other nests on Horseshoe Rock and Bastard's Cradle. Without Lord Redwyn's fleet, we lack the ships to come to grips with them.
"What is Lord Hightower doing?" Sam blurted. "My father always said he was as wealthy as the Lannisters, and could command thrice as many swords as any of Highgarden's other bannermen."
"More, if he sweeps the cobblestones," the captain said. "But swords are no good against the Iron Men, unless the men who wield them know how to walk on water."
"The Hightower must be doing something."
"To be sure. Lord Leighton's locked atop his tower, with the mad maid consulting books of spells. Might be he'll raise an army from the deeps, or not. Baylor's building galleys. Gunther has charge of the harbour. Garth is training new recruits, and Humphrey's gone to Lys to hire sail sails. If he can winkle a proper fleet out of his whore of a sister, we can start paying back the Iron Men with some of their own coin. Till then, the best we can do is guard the sound and wait for the Bitch Queen in King's Landing to let Lord Paxter off his leash."
The bitterness of the captain's final words shocked Sam as much as the things he'd said.
"If King's Landing loses Old Town and the harbour, the whole realm will fall to pieces,"
he thought as he watched the Huntress and her sisters moving off. It made him wonder if even Horn Hill was truly safe. The Tarly lands lay inland, amidst the thickly wooded foothills, 100 leagues northeast of Old Town, and a long way from any coast. They should be well beyond the reach of Iron Men and longships. Even with his lord father off fighting in the Riverlands, and the castle lightly held. The young wolf had no doubt thought the same was true of Winterfell, until the night that Theon Turncloak scaled his walls. Sam could not bear the thought that he might have brought Gilly and her baby all this long way to keep them out of harm, only to abandon them in the midst of war. He wrestled with his doubts through the rest of the voyage, wondering what to do. He could keep Gilly with him in Old Town, he supposed. The city's walls were much more formidable than those of his father's castle, and had thousands of men to defend them, as opposed to the handful Lord Randall would have left at Horn Hill when he marched to Highgarden to answer his liege lord's summons. If he did, though, he would need to hide her somehow. The citadel did not permit its novices to keep wives or paramours, at least not openly.
"Besides, if I stay with Gilly very much longer, how will I ever find the strength to leave her?"
He had to leave her, or desert.
"I said the words," Sam reminded himself. "If I desert, it will mean my head. And how will that help Gilly?"
He considered begging Kojo Mo and her father to take the wildling girl with them to the Summer Isles. That path had its perils too, however. When the cinnamon wind left Old Town, she would need to cross the Red Wind Straits again, and this time she might not be so fortunate. What if the wind died, and the Summer Islanders found themselves becalmed? If the tales he'd heard were true, Gilly would be carried off for a thrall or salt wife, and the babe was like to be chucked into the sea as a nuisance.
"It has to be Orne Hill," Sam finally decided. "Once we reach Old Town, I'll hire a wagon and some horses and take her there myself."
That way he could make certain of the castle and its garrison. And if any part of what he saw or heard gave him pause, he could just turn around and bring Gilly back to Old Town. They reached Old Town on a cold, damp morning, when the fog was so thick
that the beacon of the High Tower was the only part of the city to be seen. A boom stretched across the harbour, linking 24 rotted hulks. Just behind it stood a line of warships, anchored by 3 big Drummonds and Lord Hightower's towering 4-deck banner ship, the Honour of Old Town. Once again, the Cinnamon Wind had to submit to inspection. This time it was Lord Leighton's son, Gunther, who came aboard, in a cloth of silver cloak and a suit of grey enamel scales. Sir Gunther had studied at the Citadel for several years and spoke the summer tongue, so he and Kururomo adjourned to the captain's cabin for a private conference. Sam used the time to explain his plans to Jilly. First, the Citadel, to present John's letters and tell them of Master Aemon's death. I expect the Archmaesters will send a cart for his body. Then I will arrange for horses and a wagon to take you to my mother, at Horn Hill. I will be back as soon as I can, but it may not be until the morrow. The morrow, she repeated, and gave him a kiss for luck. At length, Sir Gunther re-emerged and gave the signal for the chain to be opened so the Cinnamon Wind could slip through the boom to dock. Sam joined Kojomo and 3 of her archers near the gangplank as the Swan ship was tying up. The Summer Islanders were resplendent in the feathered cloaks they only wore ashore. He felt a shabby thing beside them in his baggy blacks, faded cloak, and salt-stained boots. "How long will you remain in port?"
2 days, 10 days, who can say? However long it takes to enter our holds and fill them again.
Kojo grinned.
My father must visit the Grey Masters as well. He has books to sell. Can Jilly stay aboard till I return?
Jilly can stay as long as she likes.
She poked Sam in the belly with a finger.
She does not eat so much as some.
I'm not as fat as I was before, Sam said defensively.
The passage south had seen to that. All those watchers and nothing to eat but fruit and fish. Summer Islanders love fruit and fish. Sam followed the archers across the plank, but once ashore, they parted company and went their separate ways. He hoped he still remembered the way to the Citadel. Old Town was a maze, and he had no time for getting lost. The day was damp, so the cobblestones were wet and slippery underfoot, the alleys shrouded in mist and mystery. Sam avoided them as best he could, and stayed on the river road that wound along beside the Honey Wine through the heart of the old city. It felt good to have solid ground beneath his feet again instead of a rolling deck, but the walk made him feel uncomfortable all the same. He could feel eyes on him, peering down from balconies and windows, watching him from the darkened doorways. On the Cinnamon Wind he had known every face. Here, everywhere he turned, he saw another stranger. Even worse was the thought of being seen by someone who knew him. Lord Randall Tarley was known in Old Town, but little loved. Sam did not know which would be worse, to be recognized by one of his Lord Father's enemies or by one of his friends. He pulled his cloak up and quickened his pace. The gates of the Citadel were flanked by a pair of towering green sphinxes, with the bodies of lions, the wings of eagles, and the tails of serpents. One had a man's face, one a woman's. Just beyond stood Scribe's Hearth, where old towners came in search of acolytes to write their wills and read their letters. 6 bored scribes sat in open stalls waiting for some custom. At other stalls books were being bought and sold. Sam stopped at one that offered maps, and looked over a hand-drawn map of the Citadel to ascertain the shortest way to the Seneschal's court. The path divided where the statue of King Darien I sat astride his tall stone horse, his sword lifted toward dawn. A seagull was perched on the young dragon's head, and 2 more on the blade. Sam took the left fork, which ran beside the river. At the Weeping Dock, he watched 2 acolytes help an old man into a boat for the short voyage to the Bloody Isle. A young mother climbed in after him, a babe not much older than Jilly's, squalling in her arms. Beneath the dock, some cook's boys waded in the shallows, gathering frogs. A stream of pink-cheeked novices hurried by him towards the septuary.
"I should have come here when I was their age," Sam thought. "If I had run off and taken a false name, I could have disappeared amongst the other novices. Father could have pretended that Dickon was his only son. I doubt he would even have troubled to search for me, unless I took a mule to ride. Then he would have hunted me down, but only for the mule."
Outside the seneschal's court, the rectors were locking an older novice into the stocks. "Stealing food from the kitchen," one explained to the acolytes, who were waiting to pelt the captive with the rotting vegetables. They all gave Sam curious looks as he strode past, his black cloak billowing behind him like a sail. Beyond the doors he found a hall with a stone floor and high arched windows. At the far end, a man with a pinched face sat upon a raised dais, scratching in a ledger with a quill. Though the man was clad in a maester's robe, there was no chain about his neck. Sam cleared his throat.
"Good morrow."
The man glanced up and did not appear to approve of what he saw.
"You smell of novice."
"I hope to be one soon."
Sam drew out the letters John Snow had given him.
"I came from the wall with Maester Eamon, but he died during the voyage. If I could speak with the seneschal..."
"Your name?"
"Samuel. Samuel Tarley."
The man wrote the name in his ledger and waved his quill at a bench along the wall.
"Sit. You'll be called when wanted."
Sam took a seat on the bench. Others came and went. Some delivered messages and took their leave. Some spoke to the man on the dais and were sent through the door behind him and up a turnpike stair. Some joined Sam on the benches, waiting for their names to be called. A few of those who were summoned had come in after him, he was almost certain. After the fourth or fifth time that happened, he rose and crossed the room again.
"How much longer will it be?"
"The seneschal is an important man."
"I came all the way from the wall."
"Then you'll have no trouble going a bit farther."
He waved his quill.
"To that bench just there, beneath the window."
Sam returned to the bench. Another hour passed. Others entered, spoke to the man on the dais, waited a few moments, and were ushered onward. The gatekeeper did not so much as glance at Sam in all that time. The fog outside grew thinner as the day wore on, and pale sunlight slanted down through the windows. He found himself watching dust motes dance in the light. A yawn escaped him, then another. He picked at a broken blister on his palm, then leaned his head back and closed his eyes. He must have drowsed. The next he knew, the man behind the dais was calling out a name. Sam came lurching to his feet, then sat back down again when he realized it was not his name.
"You'll need to slip Locus a penny, or you'll be waiting here 3 days,"
a voice beside him said.
"What brings the night's watch to the citadel?"
The speaker was a slim, slight, comely youth, clad in doeskin breeches and a snug green brigandine with iron studs. He had skin the colour of a light brown ale, and a cap of tight black curls that came to a widow's peak above his big black eyes.
"The Lord Commander is restoring the abandoned castles," Sam explained. "We need more maesters for the ravens." "Did you say a penny?" "A penny will serve. For a silver stag, Locus will carry up to the seneschal on his back. He has been 50 years an acolyte. He hates novices, particularly novices of noble birth." "How could you tell I was of noble birth?"
"The same way you can tell that I'm half Dornish." The statement was delivered with a smile, in a soft Dornish drawl. Sam fumbled for a penny.
"Are you a novice?" "An acolyte, Alarus, by some call Sphinx."
The name gave Sam a jolt.
"The Sphinx is the riddle, not the riddler," he blurted. "Do you know what that means?"
No, is it a riddle?
I wish I knew. I'm Samuel Tarley. Sam.
Well met. And what business does Samuel Tarley have with Archmaester Theobald?
Is he the Seneschal? Said Sam, confused. Maester Aemon said his name was Norren, and not for the past two turns. There is a new one every year. They fill the office by lot, from amongst the archmaesters, most of whom regard it as a thankless task that takes them away from their true work. This year the Blackstone was drawn by Archmaester Walgrave. But Walgrave's wits are prone to wonder, so Theobald stepped up and said he'd serve his term. He's a gruff man, but a good one. Did you say Maester Aemon?
Aye.
Aemon Targaryen. Once. Most just call him Maester Aemon. He died during our voyage south.
How is it that you know of him?
How not? He was more than just the oldest living maester. He was the oldest man in Westeros, and lived through more history than Archmaester Perriston has ever learned. He could have told us much and more about his father's reign and his uncle's. How old was he, do you know?
102.
What was he doing at sea, at his age? Sam chewed on the question for a moment, wondering how much he ought to say.
The Sphinx is the riddle, not the riddler. Could Maester Aemon have meant this Sphinx?
It seemed unlikely.
Lord Commander Snow sent him away to save his life, he began hesitantly. He spoke awkwardly of King Stannis and Melisandre of Versailles, intending to stop at that. But one thing led to another, and he found himself speaking of Mance Rayder and his wildlings, King's Blood and dragons, and before he knew what was happening, all the rest came spilling out. The wights at the Fist of First Men, the other on his dead horse, the murder of the old bear at Craster's Keep, Gilly and their flight, White Tree and Small Paul, Cold Hands and the Ravens, John's becoming Lord Commander, the Blackbird, Darian, Bravos, the Dragon Zundosaur in Carth, the Cinnamon Wind and all that Maester Aemon whispered toward the end. He held back only the secrets that he had sworn to keep, about Bran Stark and his companions, and the babes Jon Snow had swapped.
Daenerys is the only hope, he concluded. Aemon said the Citadel must send her a maester at once to bring her home to Westeros before it is too late.
Alaris listened intently. He blinked from time to time, but he never laughed and never interrupted. When Sam was done, he touched him lightly on the forearm with a slim brown hand and said, "Save your penny, Sam. Theobald will not believe half of that. But there are those who might. Will you come with me?"
"Where?"
"To speak with an archmaester."
"You must tell them, Sam,"
Maester Aemon had said.
"You must tell the archmaesters."
"Very well." He could always return to the seneschal on the morrow with a penny in his hand.
"How far do we have to go?"
"Or not far. The Isle of Ravens." They did not need a boat to reach the Isle of Ravens. A weathered wooden drawbridge linked it to the eastern bank.
"The Ravenry is the oldest building at the Citadel," Alaris told him, as they crossed over the slow-flowing waters of the Honeywine. "In the Age of Heroes it was supposedly the stronghold of a pirate lord, who sat here robbing ships as they came down the river."
Moss and creeping vines covered the walls, Sam saw, and ravens walked its battlements in place of archers. The drawbridge had not been raised in living memory. It was cool and dim inside the castle walls. An ancient weirwood filled the yard, as it had since those stones had first been raised. The carved face on its trunk was grown over by the same purple moss that hung heavy from the tree's pale limbs. Half of the branches seemed dead, but elsewhere a few red leaves still rustled, and it was there the ravens liked to perch. The tree was full of them,
and there were more in the arch windows overhead around the yard. The ground was speckled by their droppings. As they crossed the yard, one flapped overhead, and he heard the others quawking to each other. Archmaester Walgrave has his chambers in the West Tower, below the White Rookery, Alaris told him. The White Ravens and the Black Ones quarrel like Dornishmen and Marches, so they keep them apart. Will Archmaester Walgrave understand what I'm telling him? Wondered Sam. You said his wits were prone to wander.
He has good days and bad ones, said Alaris, but it is not Walgrave you're going to see.
He opened the door to the North Tower and began to climb. Sam clambered up the steps behind him. There were flutterings and mutterings from above, and here and there an angry scream, as the ravens complained of being woken. At the top of the steps a pale blonde youth, about Sam's age, sat outside a door of oak and iron, staring intently into a candle flame with his right eye. His left was hidden beneath a fall of ash-blonde hair.
"What are you looking for?"
Alaris asked him.
"Your destiny? Your death?"
The blonde youth turned from the candle, blinking.
"Naked women," he said. "Who's this now?"
"Samuel, a new novice, come to see the mage."
"The citadel is not what it was," complained the blonde. "They will take anything these days, dusky dogs and Dornishmen, pig-boys, cripples, cretins, and now a black-clad whale. And here I thought leviathans were grey."
A half-cape striped in green and gold draped one shoulder. He was very handsome, though his eyes were sly and his mouth cruel. Sam knew him.
"Leo Tyrell."
Saying the name made him feel as if he was still a boy of seven, about to wet his small clothes.
"I am Sam, from Horn Hill, Lord Randall Tarley's son."
"Truly?"
Leo gave him another look.
"I suppose you are. Your father told us all that you were dead. Or was it only that he wished you were?" He grinned. "Are you still a craven?"
"No," lied Sam. "John had made it a command. I went beyond the wall and fought in battles. They call me Sam the Slayer."
He did not know why he said it. The words just tumbled out. Leo laughed, but before he could reply, the door behind him opened.
"Get in here, Slayer,"
growled the man in the doorway.
"And you, Sphinx, now."
"Sam," said Alaris, "this is Archmaester Marwyn."
Marwyn wore a chain of many metals round his bull's neck. Save for that, he looked more like a duckside thug than a maester. His head was too big for his body, and the way it thrust forward from his shoulders, together with that slab of jaw, made him look as if he were about to tear off someone's head. Though short and squat, he was heavy in the chest and shoulders, with a round, rock-hard ale belly, straining at the laces of the leather jerkin he wore in place of robes. Bristly white hair sprouted from his ears and nostrils. His brow beetled, his nose had been broken more than once, and sour leaf had stained his teeth a mottled red. He had the biggest hands that Sam had ever seen. When Sam hesitated, one of those hands grabbed him by the arm and yanked him through the door. The room beyond was large and round. Books and scrolls were everywhere, strewn across the tables and stacked up on the floor in piles 4 feet high. Faded tapestries and ragged maps covered the stone walls. A fire was burning in the hearth, beneath a copper kettle. Whatever was inside of it smelled burned. Aside from that, the only light came from a tall black candle in the center of the room. The candle was unpleasantly bright. There was something queer about it. The flame did not flicker, even when Archmaester Marwyn closed the door so hard that papers blew off a nearby table. The light did something strange to colours, too. Whites were bright as fresh fallen snow, yellow shone like gold, reds turned to flame. But the shadows were so black they looked like holes in the world.
Sam found himself staring. The candle itself was 3 feet tall, and slender as a sword, ridged and twisted, glittering black.
"Is that, obsidian?"
said the other man in the room, a pale, fleshy, pasty-faced young fellow with round shoulders, soft hands, close-set eyes, and food stains on his robes.
"Call it dragon glass."
Archmaester Marvin glanced at the candle for a moment.
"It burns, but is not consumed."
"What feeds the flame?" asked Sam.
"What feeds a dragon's fire?"
Marvin seated himself upon a stool.
"All Valyrian sorcery was rooted in blood or fire. The sorcerers of the Freehold could see across mountains, seas, and deserts with one of these glass candles. They could enter a man's dreams and give him visions, and speak to one another half a world apart, seated before their candles. Do you think that might be useful, Slayer?"
"We would have no more need of ravens."
"Only after battles."
The Archmaester peeled a sour leaf off a bale, shoved it in his mouth, and began to chew it.
"Tell me all you told our Dornish Sphinx. I know much of it and more, but some small parts may have escaped my notice."
He was not a man to be refused. Sam hesitated a moment, then told his tale again, as Marwyn, Alaris, and the other novice listened.
"Maester Aemon believed that Daenerys Targaryen was the fulfillment of a prophecy. Her, not Stannis, nor Prince Rhaegar, nor the princeling whose head was dashed against the wall."
"Born amidst salt and smoke, beneath a bleeding star. I know the prophecy."
Marvin turned his head and spat a gob of red phlegm onto the floor.
"No, I would trust it. Goran of Old Gis once wrote that a prophecy is like a treacherous woman. She takes your member in her mouth, and you moan with the pleasure of it, and think how sweet, how fine, how good this is. And then her teeth snap shut, and your moans turn to screams. That is the nature of prophecy," said Goran. "Prophecy will bite your prick off every time."
He chewed a bit.
"Still?"
Alaris stepped up next to Sam.
"Aemon would have gone to her if he'd had the strength. He wanted us to send a maester to her to counsel her and protect her and fetch her safely home."
"Did he?"
Archmaester Marvin shrugged.
"Perhaps it's good that he died before he got to Old Town. Elsewise, the grey sheep might have had to kill him. And that would have made the poor old dears wring their wrinkled hands."
"Kill him?" Sam said, shocked. "Why?"
"If I tell you, they may need to kill you too."
Marvin smiled a ghastly smile, the juice of the sour leaf running red between his teeth.
"Who do you think killed all the dragons the last time round? Gallant dragon slayers armed with swords?"
He spat.
"The world the Citadel is building has no place in it for sorcery or prophecy or glass candles, much less for dragons. Ask yourself why Aemon Targaryen was allowed to waste his life upon the wall, when by rights he should have been raised to Archmaester. His blood was why. He could not be trusted, no more than I can."
"What will you do?" asked Alaris the Sphinx.
"Get myself to Slaver's Bay in Aemon's place. The swan ship that delivered Slayer would serve my needs well enough. The grey sheep will send their man on a galley, I don't doubt. With fair winds, I should reach her first."
Marvin glanced at Sam again and frowned.
"You? You should stay and forge your chain. If I were you, I would do it quickly. A time will come when you'll be needed on the wall."
He turned to the pasty-faced novice.
"Find Slayer a dry cell. He'll sleep here and help you tend the ravens."
But, Sam sputtered, "the other archmaesters, the seneschal, what should I tell them?"
"Tell them how wise and good they are. T-
Tell them that Aemon commanded you to put yourself into their hands. Tell them that you have always dreamed that one day you might be allowed to wear the chain and serve the greater good. That service is the highest honour and obedience the highest virtue. But say nothing of prophecies or dragons, unless you fancy poison in your porridge.
Marwyn snatched a stained leather cloak off a peg near the door and tied it tight.
Sphinx, look after this one.
I will, Alaris answered, but the Archmaester was already gone. They heard his boots stumping down the steps.
Where has he gone?
Asked Sam, bewildered.
To the docks. The mage is not a man who believes in wasting time.
Alaris smiled.
I have a confession. Ours was no chance encounter, Sam. The mage sent me to snatch you up before you spoke to Theobald. He knew that you were coming.
How?
Alaris nodded at the glass candle. Sam stared at the strange pale flame for a moment, then blinked and looked away. Outside the window, it was growing dark.
There's an empty sleeping cell under mine in the West Tower, with steps that lead right up to Walgrave's chambers, said the pasty-faced youth. If you don't mind the ravens quaking, there's a good view of the honey wine. Will that serve?
I suppose. He had to sleep somewhere.